You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 135, Ezekiel, chapters 19 and 20. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Pretty good. Feels like we're getting back at work here.
It does. Back into Ezekiel, back into the studio. It's normal as it can
be. We like normal. We like routine.
Routine is good. Yeah, I got all my screens. Like, it's just easier. I don't have to lug all of that equipment around and set it up and break it down. So this is nice.
Well, I'm back with the productivity pug, so you know, there you go. I feel better already.
And I'm sure they were happy to see you.
Oh yeah. Yep. Everybody was happy. You know, it's a long trip. You know, a week is a long time to be away.
It is. It is. Now, are you one of those that lets your dog lick you in the face?
Right. Maury, the pug, he's not that expressive. His expression actually never changes. If he's running around in circles, then you know he's happy. So he's not a big lick in the face. How many circles can I run?
But if he was, I mean, are you going to allow that to happen?
No, I'm not into that.
Okay, you're not into licking. Gotcha.
No. He does something we call the linger lick, which, like, if it's your hand, he'll lick it, and then he'll just stop with his tongue out, and he'll just look at you like it's frozen. So that's about all he does. The circle thing is a big deal, and you know he's happy.
I can't think of a better topic to discuss right before we get into Ezekiel 19.
Right. I probably could. Well, let's jump in here. Two chapters, again, 19 and 20. 19 is sort of, it's kind of straightforward, even though it's a, it uses animal and plant imagery with respect to Israel. It's actually still pretty straightforward. 20 is less so. There are some content issues in 20 that we'll get into, some controversial passages that make that require a little bit more time as far as this episode. So we'll be stilted a little bit toward chapter 20 here just because of the nature of the material. But in chapter 19, we might as well just start off by reading the chapter. It's not very long, and it's from the very beginning of it, it sort of tells you what it is. So let's just jump in here in the first verse. "And you take up a lamentation for the princes of Israel." Again, God is speaking to Ezekiel here. The word lamentation in the ESV is a translation of kinah, and that is a sort of a technical literary term within the Hebrew Bible and outside as well. But lamentation is a good translation. We'll get into that in a moment. So let's just continue reading. "Take up a lamentation for the princes of Israel and say, what was your mother? A lioness. Among lions she crouched. In the midst of young lions she reared her cubs. And she brought up one of her cubs, and he became a young lion. And he learned to catch prey. He devoured men. The nations heard about him. He was caught in their pit, and they brought him with hooks to the land of Egypt. When she saw that she waited in vain, that her hope was lost, she took another of her cubs and made him a young lion. He prowled among the lions. He became a young lion. He learned to catch prey. He devoured men and seized their widows. He laid waste their cities, and the land was appalled and all who were in it at the sound of his roaring. Then the nation set against him from provinces on every side. They spread their net over him. He was taken in their pit. With hooks they put him in a cage and brought him to the king of Babylon. They brought him into custody, that his voice should no more be heard on the mountains of Israel. Verse 10, your mother was like a vine in a vineyard, planted by the water." So here the imagery changes. "Fruitful and full of branches by reason of abundant water. Its strong stems became ruler's scepters. It towered aloft among the thick boughs. It was seen in its height with the mass of its branches. But the vine was plucked up in fury, cast down to the ground. The east wind dried up its fruit. They were stripped off and withered. As for its strong stem, fire consumed it. Now it is planted in the wilderness, in a dry and thirsty land, and fire has gone out from the stem of its shoots, has consumed its fruit, so that there remains in it no strong stem, no scepter for ruling. This is a lamentation and has become a lamentation. So we'll stop there. That's the end of chapter 19. We've seen this sort of thing before in the book of Ezekiel. If you remember back in chapter 17, we went through a parable about two eagles that actually described historical circumstances of the rebellious nation. This one, scholars again tend to classify not as a parable. They classify it as a lament because of the word kinah. Block, however, even though he recognizes that this is a lamentation, he considers it sort of a parody and not a quote-unquote true lament. In other words, Ezekiel isn't lamenting what happens. Well, again, that's a bit of a value judgment. How would we really, you know what Ezekiel was thinking when God, you know, tells him to write all this stuff? So, you know, be that as it may, we've got a kinah, a lament. Maybe it's a parody, maybe it isn't. You know, again, we're not going to psychologize Ezekiel too much here, but let's just go with what we know. Now, Taylor has a bit of a summary here, I think, that is a little helpful in kind of learning what this means. And I'm actually going to use this to make, some theological comments. He writes in his little Tyndale commentary, "This poem is the first example Ezekiel has given us of the kinah, variously translated lamentation, dirge, elegy. It consists of a composition written in the distinctive mournful tones of the kinah rhythm, in which the two members of the couplet," this is the poetic couplet here, "are of unequal length in the pattern of 3-2, three beats or three, segments or three accents, and however you want to characterize that, 3-2. Only rarely can this rhythm be caught in an English translation, because in Hebrew the beats are usually one to a word, and when translated, a single Hebrew word often needs several English words to express its meaning. However, verse 2b illustrates the meter the best." And Taylor has this for a translation: "In the midst of lions she couched, rearing her whelps." So we've got sort of three segments, and then the follow-up line is two segments. Other examples of the same meter in Ezekiel are found in, various passages, chapter 26, verse 17 and following, chapter 27, chapter 28, 32, so on and so forth. It occurs frequently elsewhere in the Old Testament, especially in the Psalms and in prophetic laments, and of course is typical of the book of Lamentations. So that's the end of his quote. Now, for those who, are completely unfamiliar with Hebrew poetry, we're used to poetry that rhymes in sound. Okay, think of a song. The end of a line. It should rhyme with the something previous. We look for rhyming and we think of rhyming in terms of how things sound. Hebrew poetry, parallelism is sort of the academic word for it, doesn't rhyme in sound. It rhymes in thought. So you have that difference. Plus, when a Hebrew writer wanted to do poetry, there were certain patterns. Now, we have this in English poetry. Anybody who's taken like a poetry class is going to know this, or is a songwriter. You might have one line that has, four elements, another next thing has two, and then you repeat the pattern and so on and so forth. So Hebrew poetry, has these patterns, and Taylor's quotation alludes to that. We're not going to go off into a discourse about that here. But I thought it was interesting to point it out for this particular reason. How does this help us think better, and I'm going to use that word better, about inspiration? Again, a lot of people have this notion that inspiration means that the writer's head is empty, that the writer's mind goes blank, and then God sort of fills it with words. This is the way verbal plenary, full inspiration is taught to a lot of Christians, that the writer doesn't really have much to do with the process. These are the words of God, and so God puts them in the writer's head, you know, the writer might not even be cognizant of what's going on, you know, not really even understanding, you know, what they're doing. It's just God downloads him. I've talked before on this site, you know, in the sort of, if you go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and the videos on the top page start here, we've talked about sort of false views of inspiration. I have a video up there that will help people who are new to this podcast, new to me, will help them to understand how I approach scripture. And this is one of the elements. I do not believe in a paranormal, an X-Files view of inspiration, where the content gets downloaded in the writer's head, like, and the mind blanks out, and we have some sort of automatic writing situation, and the biblical writer then later looks down at what the composition, you know, before him is and says, oh boy, I can't wait to read that. I wonder what I wrote. You know, like he's getting some sort of mystical download or mystical connection between the ethereal deity and himself, where it's just all on one side. You know, the product of, you know, what we would call inspired material is really just a product of the divine mind and not the human. The human is just some sort of fairly useless vessel through which, you know, God gives these words. You look at something like Hebrew poetry, it's very deliberate. It's artistic. It's deliberate. It's intentional. It's intelligent. It's very human. Okay, it's very human. And the Bible is full of this kind of thing. I mean, especially, you know, the stuff we're familiar with, Psalms, Proverbs. But here you have in the prophets, you know, you've got these poetic structures. You've got devices. You've got meter. You've got, you know, word pairing. It's just all these different things literarily that human beings of the period would do. So if you're aware, even to this sort of elementary level, that there's something intentional going on in the Hebrew text, that ought to affect the way you understand inspiration. It gives you yet another reason to dispense with this sort of paranormal notion about how we got the Bible. I've said it a number of times before, and I'll say it here again. If you strip the humanity out of the doctrine of inspiration, you undermine the doctrine of inspiration, because you come up with a definition that is very, very vulnerable and very falsifiable. So we need to be careful again that we sort of get this right. You know, we put the process of inspiration into real time. God picks people, prompts them through whatever means, either directly by his spirit or the events of providence, circumstances of life, to write something down. So God knew who he was picking. He knew what he was getting. He knew what their intellectual faculties were. He knew what their circumstances were. And in fact, he's been preparing them throughout their life for this moment, that they would sit down at a desk, as it were, or you know, crouch down like a scribal position, whatever, however you want to imagine this, and they would produce something that God in his providence once put down for posterity. Again, if you strip the human elements out of the Bible and make it this mystical, paranormal thing, as soon as people start to pick up on the human elements in the text, they can use that as a tool to undermine the idea of inspiration, when those things are actually of great benefit to understanding and getting a better appreciation of inspiration as a process and not a paranormal event. It's a very different perspective, but it's a very normal perspective. And I think, you know, if we believe God acts in real time with real people, this should not be a strange thought. But we're often just taught, you know, this is pejorative of what I'm going to say, we're taught a sort of goofy view of inspiration that really doesn't hold up under scrutiny. Anyway, that's the end of my little sermon there about inspiration. Let's talk about what we just read as far as the meaning. Again, even though this is a bit odd, you know, you've got the lion imagery and then later the plant imagery, it's not that difficult to figure out what's going on, what's being spoken about. You know, we have the princes of Israel in the first verse. Now, it's kind of an interesting statement, because we're going to comment on this a little bit more later. You would expect kings there, but you don't get that. You get princes of Israel, and you say, well, why would we expect kings? Well, if you go through the history, what's being described here are actually what happened to three of Israel's kings. So in verse 4, we have the nations heard about him, you know, one of Israel's cubs, you know, one of the lioness's cubs, you know, one of the princes, okay, who at one point, you know, seemed to be a good ruler, or at least, you know, have some power and authority here. The nations heard about him in verse 4. He was caught in their pit, and they brought him with hooks to the land of Egypt. Now, scholars, you know, I hate to use a word like universally, but I'm going to, because I don't really know of an exception, even though there might be one. Scholars take this basically universally as a reference to Jehoahaz. Jehoahaz was taken captive to Egypt in 609 BC. We know that from 2 Kings 23, verse 34. He reigned for a very short time, only 3 months. We know that from 2 Kings 23, verse 31, a few verses prior to him being taken to Egypt. So that's what happens to him. And because he's followed in verse 9 by this description. Another one of the princes, another one of the cubs, with hooks they put him in a cage and brought him to the king of Babylon. They brought him into custody, that his voice should no more be heard on the mountains of Israel. Well, that sounds a whole lot like what happened to Jehoiakim. Okay? Jehoiakim comes to the throne in 597 BC, so a little bit, you know, after Jehoahaz. He's 18 years old. He becomes king after his father, Jehoiakim, died. We know that from 2 Kings 24:8. He also reigns a very short time, a few months, and his reign is cut short because Babylon sacked Jerusalem. Babylon invades Jerusalem, and Jehoiakim surrenders. So he gets captured and taken to Babylon. He's brought to the king of Babylon in custody. That's what Ezekiel 19 says. So it's not a very difficult thing to align. You know, if you take the books of Kings and you assume in Ezekiel 19 that the princes of Israel are really the kings, you know, that it's not that difficult to line these up, to match them. Now, that would mean we have another reference to a third one in verse 14 of Ezekiel 19. Verse 14 says, "Fire has gone out from the stem of its shoots." So this is in the plant imagery part. "Fire has consumed its fruit so that there remains in it no strong stem, no scepter for ruling. So the kingly line is cut off." Well, that would have to be a reference to Zedekiah. Zedekiah is the last of the Davidic line. Now, if that's the case, then this is actually, you know, Ezekiel 19 is either foreshadowing what's going to happen in Jerusalem, and that could very well be, because we're only a couple chapters removed now from chapter 24, which is the destruction, the demise of the city, Jerusalem. So this is either foreshadowing what's going to happen to Zedekiah, or it could have been something that, you know, was added, you know, after the fact. It's not stated necessarily as a prophecy. If you read that verse 14, it could be stated very matter-of-factly, like this is something that's already happened. So scholars divide whether it's a prophetic idea or whether it's, again, looking retrospectively. Either way, this is the last of the Davidic line. Zedekiah had been placed on the throne as a puppet by Nebuchadnezzar after Jehoiakim was deposed and taken to Babylon. Zedekiah, we know the story. Eventually, he rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. He rebelled against Babylon. We know this from all of this from 2 Kings 24. All of these elements are in there. And of course, when word, you know, gets back to Nebuchadnezzar, hey, you got a problem here again in Jerusalem with this guy, you know, Zedekiah, Nebuchadnezzar, you know, assembles his army and goes back there himself and destroys Jerusalem in 586 BC. Again, this is very familiar in terms of the historical detail with, you know, biblical history and you know, external history as well. Zedekiah's sons, again, we just following the story, continuing on into 2 Kings 25. Verses 6 and 7, Zedekiah's sons were killed in front of him before he was blinded. They put his eyes out, and then he was taken in chains to Babylon. And then that's the end of the dynastic line, you know, until we have, you know, the son of David in the terms of, in the form of the appearance of the Messiah much later on. I mean, that's it. That's where it's drying up. So the plant metaphor, again, you know, about the stems is sort of the plant metaphor version of the cubs, you know, of the lion. The stems are no more. They're burned up. And not only is there no more strong stem, but the fruit, okay, of its shoots has been consumed. Again, the Davidic line is done. There is no scepter for ruling. That's Ezekiel 19, verse 14, a very clear reference to the end of the kingship. So chapter 19 isn't terribly difficult, you know, to figure out if you try to, again, you make the assumption that the princes of Israel are the kings, and you go back and you look in 2 Kings, the last days of the dynasty, you know, what happens to Jerusalem. It's not a difficult correlation to make. And so, you know, I'm with the overwhelming majority here that, you know, would see these references as being, you know, pretty clear. Other items of interest. Let's just, you know, hit a few other things in the chapter before we transition to chapter 20, where we have some things that are a little more substantive and difficult. The phrase princes of Israel, again, it doesn't use the normal word for king, which is Melech. This is Nasi, prince. This has actually, you know, happened earlier in the book of Ezekiel, in Ezekiel 7, for instance, in verse 27, the king mourns, the prince is wrapped in despair. There you have a reference, you have the word prince, you know, aligned with, you know, the word for king. So it gives you an indication that prince, you know, is a term that can actually be used for the one who's ruling. So there's an exegetical basis, you know, for this notion that the princes are the kings. Block, in his commentary, I'm not going to read it, but basically Block thinks that Ezekiel uses the word prince of the later Israelite kings, the ones who are, you know, reigning in Judah before Jerusalem gets destroyed. Block thinks that Ezekiel uses the other term, Nasi, instead of Melech, to sort of de-dignify them. In other words, Ezekiel has a fairly low view of the rulership, and so instead of using the word king, he uses a sort of lesser term that could just, you know, speak of leader. You know, he doesn't want to dignify these guys by calling them the king. It's possible, but again, if you go back to chapter 7, that term is used. But the other term, you know, shows up there and, of course, shows up here as well. So there might be something to that. Again, that's just Block's take on it. The lion imagery, another thing to think about here. Why is that to be expected of what's left of Israel at this time? What's left of Israel is the kingdom of Judah, the two tribes dominated by the tribe. The southern king, you know, kingdom dominated by the tribe of Judah. You also get Benjamin there, but you get the two-tribe kingdom in the south, known as Judah because most of it is the tribe of Judah. Well, that is very consistent with lion imagery. Lion imagery, again, was associated with Judah in other places. Genesis 49, Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up, so on and so forth. Micah 5:8 is another instance where you get this. The remnant of Jacob shall be among the nations in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among the flocks of sheep. So lion imagery, again, we're familiar with this, especially, you know, people who are really into prophecy, messianic imagery. The lion of Judah, again, a very familiar phrase, very familiar idea, and here you have it. Again, very easy to apply it here in Ezekiel 19. So the imagery of the lions and the lioness and the cubs and all that stuff, it should not be unfamiliar. In verse 7 in this chapter, something to point out here that, you know, might, you know, may or may not be interesting to some listeners. We have here in ESV, he seized their widows, or, you know, that the, I'll go back to verse 6. He prowled among the lions. He became a young lion. He learned to catch prey. He devoured men and seized their widows. And the next line is laid waste their cities. Well, it's kind of, you know, interesting or odd, and there are sort of text critical reasons, you know, for some of this. But what ESV has translated as seized there is actually the Hebrew term yada, which basically everywhere else, ESV and most other translations are going to translate as to know. This is the verb that is used very commonly to know things intellectually, but also it's a sexual euphemism. You know, Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived. So this is that same term. Now, if you just translate it that way, He devoured men and knew their widows, and he laid waste their cities. That would make a lot of sense. So I don't really know why ESV has seized. Knew their widows would be a reference to the new king taking the old king's harem and having sexual relations with them to assert his authority over the old king, over the old rulership. This is what you do. And we see this with Absalom when he displaces David. You know, he puts up the tent on the top of his, I can't remember what it was, his dwelling or something like that. But basically in public, full public display, you know, he has one by one, the women of the harem come in and he has his way with them because now, you know, they are his. You know, and the reason kings would do this is to establish the idea that when these women have children, they are mine. In other words, this is my line now that is taking over the rule. These are my sons. If it's somebody else's sons, they're probably going to end up dead. This is what you do. This is very, again, familiar in antiquity generally, and you certainly have instances of it in the Hebrew Bible. And I don't know why ESV just doesn't make it plain here and knew their widows, but that's what it does. So I thought I would mention that. Maybe the reason some translations do this, even though there's really no precedent to translate yada as seized. Yes, I've come across arguments where the word widows is the issue. The word widows is almanot. And some people say, well, that's what the Masoretic text has. And, you know the widows, you know, again, to me, it's clear. But some people say, well, it's kind of an odd expression to know the widows. And, well, you know, just go with it now. Even again, though, I don't think it's odd at all. But they would say, well, that's a little odd. So maybe instead of almanot, maybe the text should read armanot. You know, the scribe messed up a letter. Armanot is the word for citadels. And they would say, well, citadels goes better with cities, laid waste their cities in the next line. Oh, okay. But you still have then he knew their citadels. I mean, how does that make any sense? But I mean, you'll see that reflected in a few translations, maybe some commentaries if you're studying Ezekiel, you know, along with us here. I think the Masoretic text is just fine here. He knew their widows. In other words, it's taking control of the harem. Again, I don't see what's difficult about it. Verse 9, with hooks they put him in a cage. It's kind of interesting here, the word cage here, Taylor notes, is the Hebrew term shugar, which is actually a loan word from Akkadian, shigaru, and it refers either to an animal's cage or a neck band with which lines of prisoners were roped together. In modern Hebrew, this is the term for dog collar. So it could be not that the king in verse 9 was put in a literal cage, but it could be a reference to he was collared. Again, put this wooden or whatever this device, this neck band around him and roped a bunch of people together, and he was one of them. That's how they went off to Babylon. So in other words, he doesn't get a ride in a cage back. He has to walk back chained by the neck. So it's sort of an interesting lexical, cultural, you know, kind of note I thought I'd mention. Let's go into chapter 20. We get some things in here that are going to take us into this, the kind of stuff that we on this podcast at least sort of like, you know, Israelite religion and some of the, you know, maybe some of the darker elements of that. Again, there's some controversy here in this chapter when we get to Ezekiel 20. I don't really want to take the time to read the whole thing, but you know, we might end up doing that. But what we have here in chapter 20 is, in a nutshell, a description, kind of an overview, not necessarily a travelogue, but an overview of Israel's past history. And naturally, when Israel's history gets overviewed, it's going to be about, especially if it's in the prophets, it's going to be about how bad Israel was. They're you know, constant complaining, their constant rebellion against the Lord. Again, this is going to be described either in prose narrative, or it's going to have, you know, certain imagery associated with just being a pain in God's neck, so to speak. Just this constant resistance and complaining and rebellion, and of course apostasy as well. Deuteronomy 32, you know, is another one of these where, you know, the chapter goes through Israel's behavior, you know, from Egypt on into the wilderness and how they went astray and worshiped other gods and so on and so forth. Well, that's kind of what you're going to get here. in Ezekiel 20. Taylor notes that in the process of doing this, there are a number of themes that reoccur. They're repetitive. One is, of course, the rebelliousness of Israel, despite God's mercy. That's going to be a thing that's repeated. Another one is the wilderness wanderings themselves. Again, constant reference to that. And thirdly, the motive of Yahweh's concern for his own name. This is in this chapter, this is going to be repeated a number of times, and repeatedly, it's the reason why God acts to deliver them, because I'm going to do this for the sake of my own reputation. And that language to us is familiar, either through preaching or, again, our own reading of the Old Testament, you know, God doing something for the sake of his name. But we sometimes don't situate that in the context of the Deuteronomy 32 worldview, where God has extracted, or he hasn't extracted because they don't exist yet, but God has decided to elect or choose his own nation, and it's not one of these. He abandons, he disinherits the other nations to the lesser gods, to the sons of God, Deuteronomy 32:8, and then he creates Israel, you know, from Abraham right after the Babel incident. So, you know, God had these are all God's decisions, you know, to disinherit this bunch and to create a new nation, you know, from the loins of Abraham and of course, Sarah. This is God's decision to do that. And so if he just sort of lets them die, lets them, you know, fade into history, if he doesn't intervene, if he doesn't save a remnant, then the other nations, of course, and again, think about it, their gods could look at Yahweh and think all sorts of things like, oh, you were inept, you were impotent, you couldn't pull this off, what a stupid idea. So God acts in the interest of his own name, his own person. So I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment, because that's, again, a recurring thing that's sort of a big deal in chapter 20, but there are other things here. So in verse 1, we might as well just jump into it here. In the seventh year, in the fifth month, on the 10th day of the month, certain of the elders of Israel came to inquire of the Lord, and sat before me. And the word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, speak to the elders of Israel, and say to them, Thus says the Lord God, is it to inquire of me that you have come? As I live, declares the Lord God, I will not be inquired of by you. We'll just stop there. So that's the first three verses. Now, we've seen something like this before. You know, we get the date formula. It works out to July or August 591 BC. So we're still, you know, a few years from the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. But Ezekiel was taken in the second wave of captivity. The elders, you know, who are there with him, the Jewish leadership that's there in Babylon, they show up. And they've done this before in chapter 14. They come, you know, and they sit at Ezekiel's feet. Well, again, if you recall the discussion back then, maybe they've come again here in chapter 20 in the hope of hearing some news about the homeland. You know, what do you know? Has God shown you anything, Ezekiel, about what's going on back there? Or maybe, you know, has God said anything to you about how long we're going to be here? When are we getting out of here? That sort of thing. And it's probably the latter in terms of God's response. You know, as I live, declares the Lord God, I'm not going to be inquired of by you. Basically, my timetable isn't going to be arranged and carried out on the basis of what you want. It's just not going to happen. So, you know, God isn't very pliant here, you know, when the elders show up again. And we've seen, you know, earlier in chapter 14, other chapters, why? Because they're just as bad as the generations that have preceded them. So, yeah, you're here and you're alive. You should be thanking God that you're alive. But that doesn't mean that God looks at you as though you're any better than the people who've lost their lives and the people who will lose their lives, you know, back in Jerusalem. And we talked about that a lot with Ezekiel 18, with the individual accountability issue. Verse 4, you know, God again speaking to Ezekiel, will you judge them, son of man? Will you judge them? Let them know the abominations of their fathers. Now, here we're back to this, you know, sins of the fathers thing, which we just talked about with Ezekiel 18. So the question here would be, does this contradict chapter 18? Chapter 18's emphasis on individual accountability. And the answer is the same here as it was in chapter 18. The answer is no. Remember when we talked about chapter 18, that the sins of the fathers language, yeah, that's part of why the exile was happening, but it wasn't the whole basis. Chapter 18 also reminded us that the current generation of Israelites were just as much to blame. So there'd only be a contradiction if the current generation was innocent. Hey, why are we getting punished for the sins of our fathers? Okay, but that isn't the case, right? They're also just as bad. They aren't innocent. Block writes here, I think a nice little summary. Yahweh's disposition toward Israel is transparent. To him, the nation has historically been merely one of the Canaanite nations. In his development of this thesis, the prophet will raise two primary arguments. You were just like the other ones. You know, I chose you, and so on and so forth. And that act of grace, choosing you when I had disinherited all the other ones, is making Yahweh angry because of their response to it. Again, what do we expect? You know, God to think God, you know, is basically saying, look, the whole nation, its whole history, and this is really, again, part of the point of chapter 20, rehearsing the whole history. From the day I brought you people out of Egypt up until now, this has been your pattern. Again, you're no more innocent than the generations that preceded. This has been the consistent, constant pattern. So what you have in chapter 20, really from this point on, we're at verse 5 here, all the way to verse 31, which is going to be pretty close to the end of the chapter. What you have is, again, a kind of wholesale arraignment or accusation or rehearsal of Israel's apostasy up to the present day. That's the purpose of this chapter, again, to reiterate this point. If you go to verse 5, we'll pick up there. So God says, say to them, thus says the Lord God, on the day when I chose Israel, I swore to the offspring of the house of Jacob, making myself known to them in the land of Egypt. I swore to them, saying, I am the Lord your God. On that day I swore to them that I would bring them out of the land of Egypt into a land that I had searched out for them, a land flowing with milk and honey, the most glorious of all lands. And I said to them, cast away the detestable things your eyes feast on, every one of you, and do not defile yourselves with the idols of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. But they rebelled against me and were not willing to listen to me. None of them cast away the detestable things their eyes feasted on, nor did they forsake the idols of Egypt. Then I said, I would pour out my wrath upon them and spend my anger against them in the midst of the land of Egypt. But I acted for the sake of my name, that it should not be profaned in the sight of the nations among whom they lived, in whose sight I made myself known to them in bringing them out of the land of Egypt. So I led them out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness. I gave them my statutes and made known to them my rules, by which if a person does them, he shall live. Moreover, I gave them my Sabbaths as a sign between me and them, that they might know that I am the Lord who sanctifies them. But the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness, just like Egypt. They did not walk in my statutes, but rejected my rules, by which if a person does them, he shall live. And my Sabbaths they greatly profaned. And I said, I would pour out my wrath upon them in the wilderness to make a full end of them. Verse 14, but I acted for the sake of my name, that it should not be profaned in the sight of the nations in whose sight I had brought them out. And so on and so forth. I mean, this is the pattern, you know, that this is what you did. This is how you reacted to my grace. And I should have just, you know, sort of rid myself of you, but I didn't because of the sake of my name. You know, this is the pattern that you're going to get throughout the chapter. A few things here before we jump back in. Did you notice in verse 5, the wording, on the day when I chose Israel? And it was a reference to Israel being in Egypt there in verses 5 through 9. Now, that takes us into a couple of difficulties or maybe even potential difficulties. Perhaps a better word would be just several issues related to the names of God and Israelites' history. And if you think, Mike, I don't know what you're talking about here. Well, did God choose Israel when they were in Egypt? Well, what about the patriarchs? Didn't God choose to create Israel from nothing? Speaking theologically there, because they didn't exist, but he obviously uses Abraham and Sarah to start the nation. Wasn't that long before Egypt? You know, what's this language about the day I chose Israel. And it's a reference to going down to them in Egypt and saying, forsake your gods. And then he takes them out of Egypt. I mean, what's going on here? Now, Block writes, and then I'm going to give my two cents after this. The selective nature of Ezekiel's use of Israel's sacred traditions here is obvious. He is silent on Egypt as a house of slavery and on Yahweh's redemptive activity, at least in that respect. Israel's history commences with Yahweh's election, self-revelation, covenant, and promise. Why he began his history of Israel in Egypt rather than with the patriarchs is not clear. He was surely familiar with the priestly tradition of the Abrahamic covenant, by which Yahweh promised to enter into a special relationship with the patriarch and his descendants, and to give them the entire land of Canaan as their own possession. Perhaps the prophet perceived the patriarchs as the pious archetypal recipients of God's blessings. And Block makes a note here of Ezekiel 33:24 in that regard, which says, "Son of man, the inhabitants of these waste places in the land of Israel keep saying, Abraham was only one man, and yet he got possession of the land, but we are many, and the land is surely given us to possess." So it's evident that Ezekiel knows about the patriarchs, is Block's point, and that Abraham was a godly man. So why not begin with Abraham? Now back to Block. More likely, Ezekiel seems to have grasped the full significance of Israel's encounter with Yahweh in Egypt. The patriarchal traditions were too closely linked with El Shaddai, the divine name associated with the promises of covenant relationship. But Egypt is the place where promises are fulfilled. And according to Exodus 6, verses 2 through 8, it is Yahweh, the same God's covenant name, that this transpires. Now this takes us into, that's the end of the quote, this takes us into this whole issue. And I'm going to go to Exodus chapter 6, and the key verse is actually verse 3, but I'll begin in verse 2. God spoke to Moses and said to him, "I am the Lord." Okay, I am Yahweh, it's the divine name there. "I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as El Shaddai, God Almighty. But by my name, Yahweh, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them." Okay, so you look at that, and source critics, again, people who would, you know, be married to proponents of the JEDP theory, this is a key verse for them, because to them, this justifies dividing up the Pentateuch, the Torah, into sources. One of the criteria of which would be divine names. You know, there's the J source, that's the Jehovah or the Yahwist source, and then E would be L words like El Shaddai or El or Elohim or something like that. So this is, if you're familiar with JEDP, this is one of not, this isn't the only one, but it's one of, you know, maybe good 6, 7, 8 criteria, you know, to divide the Pentateuch, the Torah, into sources. So this passage is a big deal because it says very plainly, or at least it seems to say very plainly, "I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, but by my name Yahweh, I didn't make myself known to them." So, you know, I don't want to, you know, go off into JEDP. I've blogged about this verse before. There is another way to understand the syntax where it doesn't draw this hard and fast distinction between the names, and so there's that. But for our purposes here, what Block is saying when he brings this up is that, look, if we take Exodus 6 here sort of at face value, God has appeared to Moses on the mountain, the burning bush incident, where he does what? He reveals the name. "I am that I am." Ehyah, Ehyah, okay. And Ehyah is from Hayah or Hava in Old Semitic. "I am," or "I cause to be," or something like that. Again, I have a thing on the website about the meaning of the divine name. You could just go up there and look at that and read it. But at any point, at the burning bush, God, in the story, at least, you know, introduces himself to Moses by this particular name. Now, you're going to read, of course, in your English Bible, you're going to read lots of stories up to Exodus all the way through Genesis, and you're going to see the divine name here and there. And again, people would say, well, that's the sources being brought together, and this is editing, and Moses didn't write this stuff. Again, we're putting all that aside. If you go with the biblical story, if you take Exodus 6 to mean what it says, then this incident historically speaking, okay, in the flow of Israel's history, this would be the incident right here where we have this covenant name given to Moses. So if we take it for what it is, this is sort of a turning point, and it happens in conjunction with God saying, I've heard the cries of my people in Egypt. I'm going to go down there and send you down there. We're going to get them out. You know, and Israel's going to be reborn as a nation. So that might be what Ezekiel's thinking when he says, when I chose Egypt, on the day I chose Egypt, you know, all this language of, or excuse me, chose Israel, you know, when they were in Egypt. This may be what he's thinking of this incident, you know, when God comes to Moses and says, well, I want you now to refer to me as Yahweh, okay, because I am that I am. Yahweh is the third person form of Hayah or Hava. That's where it comes from. So this would be a turning point in the history of the people. And so, you know, maybe, you know, okay, maybe this is what Ezekiel's thinking. Maybe this is why he sort of starts the history of the people in Egypt rather than with the patriarchs. Could be. Again, we don't really know, you know, for sure. But it's kind of an interesting point, because if you read this, you know, even it's clear enough in your English Bible, you read Ezekiel 20 and you might think, well, wait a minute. This isn't really when Israel as a people began. It began with the selection of Abraham and Sarah and supernaturally enabling them to have a child and all that stuff. What about that? You know, Ezekiel, why are you starting with the people in Egypt? Well, this might be the reason, the revealing of the covenant name, because Yahweh, again, I'm in the minority of scholars here, and there are really technical, philological reasons why people dispute this, none of which I think are very compelling, but that's me. Yahweh, I think, I'm with Frank Moore Cross here at Harvard, who's now deceased, but he was the guy who did the most work here, I think the most important work here. Yahweh means he who causes to be, he who causes to become or to come into existence, that sort of thing. And that would really fit well with the context, because the point is not that there are no Israelites. The point is now that Israel is not its own entity. They're slaves in Egypt. And I'm going to send Moses down there and bring them out, and we're going to, you know, rebirth them. They are now going to become a nation. This is something new. And I'm going to cause this to be by my power. I'm going to go down there, and through acts of power, I'm going to defeat the gods of Egypt and bring them out, and they will be my people. And that makes a lot of sense to me. There are reasons why, you know, other critical scholars resist that, but again, I'm not going to bore you with all those details. But I think it is coherent, you know, what Block is suggesting here. This may be what Ezekiel's thinking. He might be thinking of Exodus 6. He might be thinking of this moment in history, and this is why he says what he says in this particular place. Now, again, I think as far as the, you know, keys to this, you know, just adding a few thoughts to that, you know, you do get a reference to the house of Jacob, you know, here. And if you think about it, if you go back to chapter 20, let's just go there. You have here in verse 5, okay, on the day when I chose Israel, I swore to the offspring of the house of Jacob. Okay, Jacob is Israel, okay? And you know, so it's not like Ezekiel's forgotten about the patriarchs, because he mentions the house of Jacob, okay? So does that help? You know, I think, again, it helps. We can't say that Ezekiel doesn't know anything about the patriarchs or that he doesn't care. That's the point. So we need to factor that in. Secondly, if you think about the whole, you know, the line here, in verse 7, I said to them, you know, after God had brought them out of Egypt, cast away the detestable things your eyes feast on. Do not defile yourselves with the idols of Egypt. I'm the Lord your God. Again, if you're thinking of the Egyptian story, where would this come in? Well, you could say, well, the idolatry kind of did start even before the time in Egypt. Remember the story of Jacob, going back to the house of Jacob. Jacob is told to get rid of the teraphim. Okay, get rid of his gods. And we have this specific incident with Rachel where she's, you know, pretends that she's having her period and she's sitting on the teraphim and Jacob wants to get rid of, and she doesn't want to get rid of them, and that whole episode. So you do have, you know, sort of, you know, references to Israelites, people in the house of Jacob that are doing questionable religious things even before they go into Egypt. So we don't read about idolatry in the early chapters of Exodus, you know, when the people are slaves in Egypt. We just read about, you know, them getting delivered. So for Ezekiel, you know, to say this, you know, God, you know, in the context of the burning bush event, if Ezekiel is thinking of that, you know, and he's thinking, hey, this is when Israel was called, you know, this is when Israel was chosen. God picked them out of Egypt, and he told them, you know, quit being idolaters. You might look at that and say, well, there's nothing in the book of Exodus about their idolatry. Well, you have this thing before they go down to Egypt, so that, you know, there could have been this thing going on. Who's to say what they were doing in Egypt is really what I want you to think about. There's no indication in the Torah anywhere about what the Israelites were doing religiously in Egypt. We don't know if they were all pure Yahweh worshipers. We don't know if some of them sort of redefined the worship of Yahweh in idolatrous ways. I mean, we've read that even in the book of Ezekiel itself. People were doing that thinking they were worshiping Yahweh. We don't know anything. We don't know anything about what they were doing. So for Ezekiel to connect idolatry with the period in Egypt, even though we don't read about that specifically in the early chapters of Exodus, again, that should not be viewed as some sort of historical mistake, or, you know, Ezekiel's like, doesn't know what he's talking about. He certainly know better than we do, because he's, you know, closer to the fact, and they're going to have their own traditions and whatnot. You can make the argument that even though this is an argument from silence, we don't know anything, it's reasonable to think that the Israelites would have, you know, while they were in Egypt, there would have been a mixture of idolatry in there, because, hey, every time, every place else that we read about them, every other moment in their history, every other period, they're doing that. So why would that be an exception? Again, that's a reasonable argument. I would add this, though, that I think this could be a reference to what happens at Sinai, you know, the whole golden calf incident. And I think if we know how to read that a little bit better, we can make an argument. Again, I'll be honest, it's an implied argument that Israel in Egypt during the period of slavery were not theologically pure. The nation was not theologically pure as the driven snow here. And I think, again, we can make a reasonable argument based on what happens at Sinai. Now, if you remember the story of the golden calf, okay, they're there at the foot of the mountain. And, you know, we have Moses go up. He doesn't come back for a long time. Again, we know the story. And so Aaron is talked into, you know, he's weak, you know, he's talked into making a golden calf, you know, for the people to worship. This is the God or the gods who brought you out of Egypt, and so on and so forth. And we look at that and we think, what a bunch of idiots. You know, how in the world could they make, you know, how is it reasonable at all to have gone through the Red Sea event and then to get to Sinai and look at this golden calf and say, well, this is the God who brought us out of Egypt. I mean, again, it makes them look like morons. Well, maybe not. Again, maybe this is what they're thinking. Now, follow along here. This is a calf, okay? Golden calf there at Sinai. In Israelite thinking, this may have been the way they conceived of, wrongly, aberrantly, this may have been the way they conceived of their God, as a calf, or more particularly as a bull. You say, what are you talking about, Mike? Well, in Genesis 49:24, we have a phrase where God is called, the God of Israel is called, the Mighty One of Jacob, the Avir Yaakov. This is a title of Yahweh in Psalm 132:2, Isaiah 49:26, Isaiah 60:16. This is much later material. Avir is Aleph, Bet, Yod, Resh, for those who know Hebrew. It is spelled identically to the word for bull, Aleph, Bet, with a dagesh in it, Yod, Resh. Okay, so in terms of consonants, there's no difference here. This is why some scholars think Mighty One of Jacob could be translated the Bull of Jacob. This is the same word that you get in Psalm 22 for the bulls of Bashan, by the way, and just bulls generically. You say, well, why would we care? Here's why you'd care. Because Canaanite El, again, the lead god of the Canaanite pantheon, is referred to as a bull in Ugaritic texts. Now, it's a different term. It's the Ugaritic equivalent of Shor. Hebrew Shor is bull. Thur is the Ugaritic term. But here's the point. Since we know that that El, again, Canaanite El, was viewed as the highest deity. And we also know, again, from the Hebrew Bible, that the God of Israel is referred to with the same term El, and we can argue about whether it's a proper name or not, but it's just the term for deity. And we have El Shaddai, we have El Elyon, we have El this, El that, you know, all these things for the God of Israel. In the minds of many Israelites, you got to realize, folks, people don't have Bibles. They don't even have teachers. There's no written revelation at all. Okay, so when they're thinking, you know, of the high God, it's quite plausible to think that at least some Israelites would have conflated El from Canaan or Ugarit with the God of the patriarchs. It's very reasonable to think that. And so if that God is you know, one of the way he's described is a bull, and then you make a golden calf at Sinai and you say, well, this is the God who brought you out of Egypt, there'd be a lot of Israelites that would look at that and say, well, yeah, we get that. That makes sense. Let's have a party. And again, it's still idolatry, again, because, you know, we know what God's reaction to it is. We know we're going to get, you know, one of the commands about not making graven. We know all that. But the people there, again, could be doing the same kind of thing we see later in the book of Ezekiel. You know, when they're bowing down to the sun, they think they're worshiping Yahweh, you know, because he's the highest, you know, God up in the heavens. And, you know, again, they're doing the sort of religious math that wouldn't have been strange to many of them. Now, it's worse for the people later in Israel's history in the book of Ezekiel, back with the solar worshipers and all that. It's worse because they do have written material. They know they're not supposed to be making images of things in heaven and earth, you know, all that. They know that. Well, the people at Sinai don't have any of that. So it's very conceivable that this act that they do at Sinai to many Israelites there made sense. And that, but then you're going to have some that say, well, I think we should wait for Moses to come down to the mountain. You know, it's just, I don't know about this because this is like, you know, just kind of looks like what Egyptians would do, you know, and what other peoples would do. And we should wait for Moses. We don't know if he's, you know, the whole thing playing out. Again, what I'm saying is Ezekiel, again, might have been thinking of this sort of incident and this sort of religious behavior back at Sinai. And if that's the case, that could indicate, here's your implied argument for what's going on with Israelites while they're in Egypt as slaves. They could have been doing this all along. They could have been worshiping the God of their fathers, the God of the patriarchs, with idols, or they could have thought of him in these terms. We just don't know. We're not told in Exodus what the situation was, but you get an episode like this, where if you put yourself in that historical context, and again, you look at it, I mean, we can look at it and we have a wider net here. We can look at how Yahweh is described in certain passages as the Avir, okay, which is can certainly be translated bull. We look at that sort of thing, and again, without them knowing really any better, that's what they could have been doing. That could have been Yahweh worship in Egypt during the years of bondage. And it's not like God's happy with it because they're slaves. They're slaves in Egypt. And, you know, God decides, again, at the time of Moses, okay, we're going to act. I'm going to get them out of Egypt. We're going to bring them back to this mountain, and you're going to tell them who I am. We're going to refer to me by this covenant name. This is my covenant name. I am bringing them out. I am making them anew. This is the new birth for the nation. It's a reset button. Okay, we're going to hit the reset button here. You're going to bring them to this mountain. I'm going to give them my laws. I'm going to give them the commands. I'm going to spell it out for them, how I want to be worshipped, how I don't want to be worshipped. Now, they could have intuited this. They could have intuited this much, you know, based on the patriarchs. The patriarchs were, you know, commanded, you know, to put away other gods, which would have, you know, with that worship would have been the making of idols. They could have figured that much out. You know, because the patriarchs were required to do that sort of thing. When God does show up, he either shows up as a man or it's some sort of, you know, luminescence of, you know, the fiery flame, you know, that kind of thing. You know, the fiery pot that passes between the animals in Genesis 15, all this sort of stuff. There's no indication that the God of the patriarchs wanted to have graven images made of him so that people could worship him. So if they even pass that much down orally, It doesn't even have to be written. Even if you pass the stories down orally, you would think when you get to Sinai, there's going to be a bunch of Israelites thinking, well, yeah, you know, I don't know about this. You know, that, so they could say, well, yeah, my neighbor, you know, Shlomo over here, we were down in Egypt living in the slave quarters. You know, he had an idol and he called it Yahweh. And I guess, he called it, you know, the God of my fathers, you know, El, whatever. And, you know, okay, that's what he did. We didn't really do that because we just thought that was, we didn't know why we should be doing that. Kind of felt weird, you know, whatever. We just don't know what's going through the heads of these people. But if they had transmitted the stories orally, making a graven image to worship the God of the patriarchs was not something that you would see or hear or have told you as the thing to do. But you could see how people would think it's reasonable or okay or allowable because of the terminology that would have been part of this matrix, this complex of stories. So when God does send Moses back to Egypt and gets them out, brings them back to Sinai, it's like, this is the reset button. This is where we're going to set the record straight. And they should have waited for Moses. Why would they think Moses would go up on the mountain and God would just kill him or let him die after the deliverance at the Red Sea? I mean, come on. Does that just wouldn't, I look at it, and I'm looking at it 2020 hindsight here, but I think it's equally reasonable to think that you'd have Israelites sitting in the camp thinking, there's just no way God would just kill this guy or let him die now. After all this, we need to wait for Moses. We need to hear what God has to say. We should not be making this calf. And other ones would like, well, you know, hey, it's the bull. It's the God of the patriarchs. What's the problem? So you're going to have, you know, a real difference there. And this could be, again, what Ezekiel's thinking of. You know, do with that what you want. But again, this is how, you know, scholars are going to be talking about this passage, about why Ezekiel is thinking Egypt for the birth and the election of the people instead of Abraham. Okay, this is why that would be. Now in verse 9, again, I'm not going to go through the whole chapter, just picking a few things here. This reference to that we read, I acted for the sake of my name. For those who listened to the conference interviews, one of the people we interviewed was Carmen Imes. And so if you didn't listen to that, I would recommend you going back and listening to that. I don't know which number interview that was, probably either 5 or 6. But Carmen's dissertation was on linking the idea of bearing the name. Okay, this is the command, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. The word translated take in English is literally the word bear, to lift up, nasa. Right? You should not bear the name of the Lord thy God in vain, or worthlessly, or carelessly, emptily, that sort of thing. Well, bearing the name, think of it as a mark. It's you people are known by this name. You know, you are associated with this name, this deity, you know, Yahweh, okay, of Israel. And in her dissertation, she links the bearing of the name idea with the concept of imaging, okay, being a representative, being the image of God. And again, for the kind of stuff that I've written about in Unseen Realm that we've talked about here, that's why I wanted to interview her. I met her a couple of years ago at a regional meeting where she read a paper on this, you know, distilling some of these points from her dissertation. I thought, well, that's really good stuff to make this connection. So if we think about that, when we have here in verse 9, you know, I'm acting, I'm saving Israel, I'm saving these sort of transparently worthless apostates. You know, I'm going to act and I'm going to save a remnant. I'm not going to annihilate them for the sake of my name. It tells you that God, again, yes, he's acting in self-interest because, again, the Deuteronomy 32 worldview, I am not going to be laughed at by the lesser gods. My decision to disinherit them and create a new people of my own was a good one. Okay, and I will restore Eden through this bunch, okay, through this bunch of nitwits or this bunch of apostates, however you want to think about it. I will work my plan to restore Eden through these people. I will get that done. Okay, God, and again, God always acts to preserve a remnant. And it's not because he just feels bad. It's not because there's anything special about them. It's because of himself. This is what he wants to do, and he will be shown to be right in the end. Okay, in the midst of, you know, in the minds of the other gods. Okay, his rivals. All right. So if you frame it that way, this whole, you know, to bring the idea of representation in, you could also add this thought. Another one of the reasons, yes, God is acting on self-interest, but another one of the reasons why this whole reference to the name is an issue with God is because he does want a people on earth who represent him. He does want a family. He does want Eden restored. Remember back to Eden? Creating them as the image, as his image. I want humans to image me, to represent me, to live with me, to participate with me in life in this world, in their world that I've given them. God is still after that. And so this reference to acting on the basis of his name, yeah, sure, it is self-interest. It's about his reputation. But when you tie it into the larger picture, it also tells you God wants to accomplish the restoration of his original plan. He wants human imagers. And these are the people through which he is going to work the original plan and get the job done. So again, there's a lot of theology that sort of accrues, you know, to just these statements about the name. That I think, you know, commentators, you know, some commentators, just a lot of them in this case, just generally miss. They don't tie it into the wider concept. So Yahweh is going to act for the sake of his name because of the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. I will be known as superior among the gods. I will be shown to be right. I will be shown to be powerful, to be able to pull this off. And when I do pull it off, I will accomplish the Edenic mission. I will have people who represent me and are part of my family in this place, and they will get to participate with me in living in this creation and enjoying it as it was meant to be enjoyed at the beginning. So again, there's a lot of theology that gets just accrued to and packed onto that. Now, the last thing I want to mention here is probably the most controversial in this chapter. And if you go to verses 24 through 26, so the rest of chapter 20, again, rehearsing Israel screwed up, but, you know, the Lord, you know, acted on the basis of his name and so on and so forth. You get down to verse 24, you get a pretty controversial statement, even within biblical scholarship and other, you know, just, you know, general readers have noticed this. He says, because they had not obeyed my rules, and God is talking about Israel, because they had not obeyed my rules, but had rejected my statutes and profaned my Sabbaths, and their eyes were set on their father's idols. Moreover, I gave them statutes that were not good and rules by which they could not have life, and I defiled them through their very gifts in their offering up all their firstborn, that I might devastate them. I did it that they might know that I am the Lord. That's verses 24 through 26. Now, some scholars think this passage means, they take it to mean, that God, and this is a key term, and this is the term I'm going to object to. Some scholars think this passage means that God endorsed child sacrifice at some point in Israelite religion. That's how they read this. Now, I think that is quite unwarranted, and of course, I'm not the only one, but just to give you an idea of how this gets discussed, some perspectives here, Taylor writes this: although once again God refrains from pouring out his wrath, he does leave Israel with two unhappy legacies, namely the threat of dispersion from Canaan among foreign peoples, verses 23 and 24, and the harmful ordinance of the offering of the firstborn, verses 25 and 26. The latter presents an acute problem of interpretation. It seems to refer to the unlawful practice of passing children through the fire to Molech, a form of child sacrifice so strongly and frequently condemned in the Old Testament that it may well have happened far more than the occasional times it is mentioned. And he cites five or six passages here. Taylor continues, But this could never be described as an ordinance of God. It may be that the ordinance referred to is that of the offering of the firstborn, with its insistence that everything that opens the womb belongs to the Lord. This is modified by the law of redemption, whereby a substitute or a ransom price can be provided for the firstborn children. The reference there is Exodus 22:29 and Numbers 18:15 and following. Now, earlier in Exodus, I believe it was Exodus 13, there was this thing about everything that's all the firstborn belong to the Lord, you know, from the animals to all to the people. And since the animals were sacrificed, you know, like some scholars would say, well, you know, that maybe they sacrificed babies, you know, back then too, like all the other pagans did. But in Exodus, later in Exodus, you know, we get a substitute for the people, you know, for the firstborn humans. There's a ransom price. So it's evident that Israel did not, okay, do this. They did not, you know, have, you know, child sacrifice back in the days of, you know, the early days of the nation. That, you know, you need to interpret it a different way based upon the other passage. Taylor continues, the occasional continuance of child sacrifice was probably due to a misinterpretation of this law, the original law about firstborn. And so Ezekiel could imply here that God had ultimately made it so, that basically the law is either ambiguous or God sees that the law is being misinterpreted and doesn't do anything, just uses that as a judgment. Taylor writes, the alternative is to understand these verses in the manner of Romans 1, specifically Romans 1:24, which is saying that the consequence of spiritual perversity is that God gives men up to grosser sins. So there, that's the end of the quotation. So Taylor is saying this could be a reference to, okay, Israelites pervert the ransom, the substitute from Exodus 22 for the firstborn, and they start practicing child sacrifice. And God looks at this and knows this is a misinterpretation, but God says, whatever. You know, he gives them up to their perversion to punish them. Okay, a la Romans 1. That's one way to look at it. Now, other scholars take a slightly different approach. I'm going to read from Greenberg's commentary here, and his view is similar to Bloch's. But Greenberg says, because Israel consistently rejected God's good, life-giving laws, God's punishment was to replace them with no good laws by observing which one would gain, by observing which one would gain not life, but death. These are then exemplified by child sacrifice, at once a murderous pagan practice and an abomination worthy of severest condemnation. By this anti-gift, God only confirmed the people in their own choices of laws countering God's good laws. In other words, it confirmed them in their rebellion. This choice led them inevitably to adopt the deadly laws of the pagans. See Deuteronomy 12:31, which illustrates the pagan mode of worship by the custom of burning children. Greenberg, again, continuing with him, the shocking idea that God misleads those who anger him into sin, for which he then destroys them, already appeared in Ezekiel 14:9. It's a reference to the God misleading the prophets that he doesn't like. Greenberg writes, it is essentially the same thing as God's hardening of Pharaoh's heart, so that his ruin might be a lasting object lesson. Or the charge to Isaiah to, quote, dull the people's mind, stop up their ears, seal their eyes, lest seeing with their eyes and hearing with their ears, they might grasp with their mind and repent and heal. Okay, so you know, God says, I'm not interested in them repenting. You know, I'm going to blind them, make their eyes, you know, close their ears. You know, this is what he tells Isaiah in Isaiah 6, verses 9 and following. Or it could be similar to the complaint of Isaiah 63:17, which says, why, Yahweh, do you make us stray from your ways and harden our hearts not to fear you? So, again, think of the hardening of the heart, you know, issue that God, and we know from this story that you know, Pharaoh also hardened his own heart. And, of course, the people here are going to be hardening themselves too. But God uses that and sort of cements it, makes it irreversible, at least for a time, to punish people that he is angry with. Okay, so that's Greenberg's, you know, view. This is that's kind of still in line with the whole idea of God gave them up to their own perversion. but it's a little bit different. But it can work with that first idea, but it's a little bit of a different take. So, you know, there you have it. You have Ezekiel here 20 verses 24 through 26. So how do we understand, again, this reference? Just to summarize the two, there are sort of other nuances of these two, but here are the two main approaches. That this is a reference to God looking at what's going on and sort of maybe more passively or apathetically saying, whatever. Okay, I'm just going to let you do that because I'm angry. I don't like you. I want you to be punished. Yeah, this is part of my judgment on you. Whereas the second view isn't quite so passive or apathetic. It's a little more active, where God uses the occasion and sort of drives them, you know, more into it to increase their judgment and their suffering and so on and so forth. So that's basically the nuance. But both views, again, have the idea of God not intervening, not putting a stop to it, because he wants the people to be judged. Again, it's a difficult passage. I don't think it means that God endorsed, okay, God was happy with, God approved of, you know, child sacrifice. I think that some critical scholars, I think, just go way, way too far with it. But those who, you know, aren't in that camp, Block, Taylor, Greenberg here, are basically looking at it in sort of a Romans 1 mode. And if you go back and read Romans 1, I would challenge you to do this. There's some pretty bad stuff in there. And you'd have to ask yourself, okay, why? You know, why isn't God like helping them see the light and taking them out of this stuff that's going to be self-destructive? All these behaviors in Romans 1 that are so self-destructive and are going to bring misery and suffering and death, you know, and blah, 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 so on and so forth. Okay, you know, we're back to the situation of God. Okay, God is omniscient. He knows basically, you know, when we've sort of crossed the line here. And God, you know, can decide the means by which he is going to punish evil. And, you know, that's up to him, you know, that sort of thing. So that's the Romans 1 perspective of, you know, God's attitude toward Israel. They're so bad. They're so apostate. I'm just going to either let them do this, or I'm going to create, you know, some sort of circumstance where I'm going to harden them into doing this to punish themselves. I want them to engage in the self-destruction because I want to destroy them. I want to punish sin. So no matter which way you look at that, I think what's remarkable in the chapter is where it goes from that point. Because when you hit Ezekiel 20, after all of that dark stuff, and you hit verse 33, you know, you read stuff, well, even before verse 33, you have here, therefore, son of man, speak to the house of Israel and say to them, thus says the Lord God, in this also your fathers blasphemy by dealing treacherously with me. And, you know, wherever they saw any high hill or any leafy tree, they offered their sacrifices, you know, to other gods. They did all this terrible stuff. So God's like, I've seen all of it before. I've seen all of it before. And then you hit verse 33. As I live, declares the Lord, surely with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and with wrath poured out, I will be king over you. I will bring you out from the peoples and gather you out of the countries where you are scattered. With a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with wrath poured out, I will bring you into the wilderness of the peoples, and there I will enter into judgment with you face to face, as I entered into judgment with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt. So I will enter into judgment with you, declares the Lord God. I will make you pass under the rod. I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. I will purge out the rebels from among you, and those who transgress against me. I will bring them out of the land where they sojourn, but they shall not enter the land of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord. As for you, O house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, go, serve every one of you his idols, now and hereafter. If you will not listen to me, but my holy name you will, if you will not listen to me, you know, go. You know, worship your idols. But my holy name you shall no more profane with your gifts and your idols. For on my holy mountain, the mountain height of Israel, declares the Lord God, there all the house of Israel, all of them, shall serve me in the land. And there I will accept them, and I will require your contributions and the choices of your gifts and your sacred offerings. As a pleasing aroma, I will accept you when I bring you out from the peoples and gather you out of the countries where you have been scattered, and I will manifest my holiness among you in the sight of all the nations. And you shall know that I am the Lord when I bring you into the land of Israel, the country that I swore to give to your fathers." I mean, after all that, God's saying, yep, go ahead, do that. You know, I've seen it all before. And that's kind of a key thought. It's kind of a key thought. God has seen it all before. And you know what? He didn't destroy the whole nation. He didn't end the whole thing. He didn't say this was a terrible idea. He doesn't give up. Okay? He preserves a remnant. And he says, look, you're going to suffer. I've seen it all before. You know, you're going to do this. I'm going to just give you over to it. And you know, it sort of, some of that reads in the past tense, if you were listening closely, you know, that this is what happened. You were taken away into these other countries. Again, it's a reference to what happens at the exile. Jerusalem's going to be destroyed. All the stuff that we've rehearsed time and time again here through Ezekiel. It's just going to hell in a handbasket. Okay, we get it. This is what is going to happen. This is what is happening. This is what has happened. And I've been here, done that with you people for centuries, for millennia. Okay, we've just been down this road before. But there's still a road. And I'm not going to just turn around and forsake you completely. I'm just not going to do that. I'm not going to just give up and say, forget it. I will bring some of you out of the countries where you're going to be scattered. I will bring you back to the land that I promised to your fathers. I will bring you back and you will be acceptable. I will accept you. Okay, there's still hope at the end of this is what I'm trying to say here. What Ezekiel is saying, God will save a remnant. And this is, a consistent message, not just in Ezekiel, but in all of the prophets, as dark as they are. And here you even get talk where the people are so bad, God says, whatever, I'm going to give you up to your perversion. I'm going to give you up to self-destruction, and I'm not going to put a stop to it. I'm going to let it play out. But in the end, God can't entirely give up on his people. You know, he always leaves the door open a crack to forgive them, to reaccept them, to bring them back, and to keep kicking the can down the road toward restoring what he really wants. God doesn't want any of this garbage. He doesn't want idolatry. He doesn't want death. He doesn't want any of this stuff. What he wants is what he set up originally in Eden, and he's going to stick with the plan. So this is a tough chapter. It's dark. Again, it has this Romans 1 feel to it. It sort of is what it is. And, you know, God is going to use their own self-destruction to judge them. It doesn't get much worse than that. But even at the end of that, we still have this message of, this is not the way the story is going to end. It's going to end a different way. It's going to end a good way. And you'll know that I am the Lord your God.
Ooh-wee. You had your tea today, Mike, didn't you? You had a couple extra glasses of tea, didn't you? Got your caffeine in.
Got my caffeine in, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Well, good deal. All right, Mike. Well, next week, chapters 21, 22?
21 and 22, yep. We're moving up to the what'll really be the transition point, the destruction of Israel. We're not destruction of Jerusalem. And the whole, you know, nation is kaput, at least for a while. Heading there, but we're not quite there yet. So two more chapters. I think we'll get there in a couple episodes.
All right. That sounds good. Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
Don't think so. Just we got some good feedback about the interviews. So that was fun, and we'll certainly do it again. So I'm glad people enjoyed that.
And don't forget, you can see pictures of the interviews on nakedbiblepodcast.com on each episode's page. So go take a look at those pictures if you haven't done so. And I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.